All right, it looks like we're building a file here as usual. So I would like to start the show, which is a departure from Scott usually starting the show. But there is no Scott
Okay.
today. This is not going to be a monologue, however. We have a surprise mystery host who was originally going to be our surprise mystery guest, but when Scott was unable to come up for air sufficiently to do the podcast this month, we immediately thought of none other than Craig Beesgeier. Welcome to the show, Craig.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. It is an absolute honor to be here, and I'm sad that Scott can't be here, but I'm more than happy to stand in his stead if I can.
Well, we
Very
needed
large shoes to fill, but I'll see what I can do.
well, we needed someone with a similar haircut, and
Oh,
if you're going to
absolutely,
be
yeah.
in this club, we have to basically be in the Simonize department as opposed to the trimmer
Absolutely,
department,
highly
right?
streamlined.
So it's good to finally get you on the show. We've been trying for about 3 or 4 months now, I guess, to get the planets to align, and it seemed like
Yeah, that's true.
every time we tried
I
to do
was
something,
away, and
you just hauled off and went to the other side of the earth.
yeah, pretty much. My job requires me to travel a lot these days, and I actually I've been doing that a lot. And then my wife and I, in February, decided that we had our 25th wedding anniversary pass recently. We decided to go to Australia,
Boy.
and that was a hell of a trip. Great fun, but it played havoc with the schedule trying to get together with you.
Well, it must have been just a brutal adjustment getting back to normal life, right?
Oh my gosh, yes, you can't imagine. It's
It's like the mother of
the
all
time
jet
change
lag.
is just, it's a killer.
Well, how long did it take you to acclimate once you got down there, and was it worse coming back?
Oh, you know what? Getting down there was no problem at all. I really thought it was going to be, but it ended up being just fine. The problem was when we came back. It took me about 2 weeks to finally get my internal clock back on time. I was waking up at 10 o'clock at night, and I'd be all like, "Okay, I'm ready to go." And then by about by about 1 o'clock the next day, I'd be like, "My eyes are just, I can't stay awake." It was terrible.
Well, you know what they always say, the East is a beast and West is best, but it sounds like you might have had
Yeah,
the
they are not
opposite.
wrong. They are no, well, I did actually head that way because, okay, it's on the other side of the world, but we went from New York to Atlanta and then to LA and then finally to Sydney. And so we did kind of head west,
Right.
and maybe that played into it. I don't
It
know.
has to. I mean, I'm not exactly sure why that is, but it's a cliche for a reason, right?
Exactly, right.
So, did you get to do any rail fanning while you were down there, or was it strictly sightseeing?
Mostly sightseeing. We did actually see some sugarcane railroading up on the Cairns area, which is in the northeast part of the country. And apparently, they have quite a lot of sugarcane that they grow there because of the climate. It's actually a really good crash crop that they do.
No kidding. I never would
And
have guessed that
when we
about
were there,
Australia.
I know, right? I didn't know that either. And it was a big surprise. It turns out that because of the time of the year that we were there, of course, it's summer there while it's winter here,
Right.
it was not harvest season yet. And so a lot of the equipment was just parked on sidings right next to the road. And so that was just fascinating to see all these small, narrow gauge, I'd like to say gondolas, but I can't even really say that. They were just kind of almost like flat cars with screen wire sides. That I guess they would just dump the stuff in from the top and take it to the processing plant. But there was tons of these cars just everywhere. And that part of it was fascinating. We actually drove by the processing plant at one point, and they had a couple of small, what looked like GE type engines. But obviously they weren't running because it's like I said, it's not harvest season, so everything was just kind of shut down.
Was
But
it
it was
a
actually pretty
Florida
interesting.
type climate in that area, you think?
It was very humid and warm. It was in, Celsius, I couldn't tell you what it was, but it felt like it was about 85, 90 while we were there for the most part.
Right.
So pretty warm, pretty humid. Yeah, I would say so.
Now you hear all kinds of cliches about Australia, like one of them is that it's a friendly place, it's a very cool place to visit, and they have some of the most intimidating bugs and creatures on the planet. Did you encounter
Oh
anything
my
like that?
God, they are not kidding.
Really?
Oh my goodness, yes. One of the places that we went to was out in the desert. You might have heard of it. It's called Ayers Rock, or as they call it, Uluru. And it's this gigantic stone found, you know, object out in the middle of the desert. There's nothing around it. It's all flat except for this gigantic big stone that sits out there. I mean, it's got to be at least a half mile, three quarters long, and it's a couple of hundred feet high. It's absolutely amazing. So we went there.
Is it like a mesa kind of a thing, a big flat top?
Yeah, it's exactly like that. That's right. And so it's like, I mean, it's just incredible to look at. So, you know, we went out to see it, and we had a wonderful time, had dinner, you know, not far from it, you know, watched the sun go down, and, you know, it's the desert, so you had all the stars. It was just incredible. But while you're there, I mean, the bugs were, like, you know, small enough to carry away children. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And I'm, like, just marveling at this hotel that we were staying at because they had lights up all around, and you know what happens when it gets dark. You know, bugs go to the light, right?
Clouds
so
of bugs.
Literally, right in front of your door, right in front of your hotel room door, there's this really bright light. And so there's these gigantic Godzilla and Mothra-type bugs just rawr, all around, flying in your face, sitting there. Oh, my God. It was just like, I can't even describe. It was horrifying.
And the locals seem to not even notice.
Oh, they don't. Yeah, it's like they're not even there. And then the other thing was that they had all these flies. And, you know, it's not like we have here with the black flies that bite.
Right.
These flies don't bite at all. But there's about 6 billion flies for every human being there. And so they are constantly in your face. And the only way that you can avoid them is you have to have it's like a net, like a beekeeper type of thing.
Right.
And you put it over your head, and it cinches around your neck like a noose. And that way they literally just can't get in your face or fly in your ears or do whatever like that. And that's the only way for 3 days I walked around with this thing on my head.
I think that would drive my wife, Karen, out of her mind.
Oh, it almost drove me out of my mind. And let me tell you, it was something. We were very happy to get on the plane and get out of there. It was lovely. We had a really good time, but that was enough.
So really, it was like that the whole time everywhere you went?
Oh, no, just at Uluru, where Ayers Rock. Everything else was just lovely. We went to Sydney, which was beautiful, and we went to Melbourne, which is a really great place if you like trams or streetcars because they're all over the place. That was really neat. And then where else did we go? We went to another place called it was up around Cairns. Yeah, I forget the name of the exact town. But that's where all the sugarcane stuff was. But we had a rare for about 2 weeks. We had an absolutely lovely time.
It sounded like a heck of a trip. I saw a lot of the photos that you were posting. And you know, I think I joked with you that the only way I could do a trip like that is on Anesthesia Airlines, you know, where they would put me out and wake me up a couple days later, and then I'd be there.
Oh, the flight is definitely the hardest part. The last leg of it going was 14 hours long.
Oh, gosh.
And flying coach, that's just a horror.
You know, I fly to California, and I'm ready to kill someone by the time I get there. You know, it's...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was totally homicidal by the time I got there, but I managed to calm down. Yeah, it's a long flight. It really is.
Well, the only reason I asked about any rail fanning there was because, you know, Australia has a reputation for being one of the other heavy haul mainline operations, like the United States, you know, and I was just wondering if you had a chance to even at a glance see anything like that.
We did actually on a bus tour heading out of Melbourne, or was it Melbourne or Sydney? I think it was Melbourne, out on the Grand Road, and we passed under an underpass, and there was a coal train running by up above. And, you know, it's really interesting because we have a real idea of what, you know, freight cars and passenger cars and locomotives look like here in the United States. And when you go somewhere else and see what it looks totally strange.
Right.
So I'm assuming that these were some sort of dump cars, but they almost looked like little short, those big, like bathtub gondolas, but they were about half the length.
Almost like an origin-y?
They looked like they were gimbal. Yeah, kind of like that, but much bigger, you know, probably about the size of what we would think of like a 55-ton hopper, but more like in the design of one of those big bathtub things. And they were just like one after the other, after the other, after the other, like a big snake. And it was really cool, but I only saw it for a few seconds.
Well, I think Australia holds some kind of a record for the world's longest or heaviest train ever run.
It might not, yeah, that wouldn't really surprise me, especially because so much of it, is, especially around the middle part of the country, is just flat. I mean, it's just
Right.
desert as far as the eye can see, and there's like no hills.
Yeah, I think
There's
it was an
there's
iron
one
ore
road.
train or something like that.
Yeah, I'm sure that's it. And, it must be coming from a pit mine or something like that. But, I mean, there's literally areas where the roads literally go hundreds of miles and they don't turn once. It's a straight line.
So it's
I
got
don't know how you
nothing.
drive on that and not get, highway hypnosis, right?
So
I'd probably.
Route 66 out in the Mojave's got nothing on Australia.
No, nothing at all. Let me tell you, it's amazing, and it's because it's another one of those things where you have to leave, and they say make sure that you bring water and gasoline because it's like 500-600 miles between stops, and there's nothing, and I mean nothing in between. If you run out of gas or you have a car problem, you are in trouble.
So the jerry cans on the back of the vehicle are not a bad idea.
They are not. They are de rigueur. Even I think you really have to have them, or you're gonna be lunch to something.
Interesting, interesting. Well, I guess I wanted to just give a brief update on Scott. He's in the middle of a couple of family things. Plus, his work has been worse than usual lately in terms of demands on his time. Plus,
Okay.
he's got those delusions of being a Major League Baseball player, and the whole thing has just kind of conspired to eliminate his availability for the foreseeable future. He
Oh,
was
dear.
going to give me an update on the laser cutting that he's doing for me, but I will not get that update until after this podcast. So, with a little luck, on the next podcast, not only will we have Scott Mason, but I'll also have my damn building. So we'll have to see how that goes.
I hear
For those on the podcast who don't even know anything about you or who the heck you are, why don't you just fill everybody in on your claim to fame?
Wow. Okay. Well, let's see.
Not to put you on the spot or anything.
No. Okay. Wow. Yeah. One of the hardest things to do is, talk about yourself, right? But well, let's see. I guess a
Just
lot of
channel your
people
inner
know me
Mason. You
because.
should be fine.
Yeah, well, a lot of people know me on your show because, as I understand it, my name gets mentioned pretty much every show.
Well, we try. We're getting
And
old and
so,
sometimes we forget.
yep. So anyway, but
I
I've
don't
been
even
around for
remember how
quite a
that got
while.
started, but it's a great tradition.
Oh, and I love it. I think it's great. It warms my heart. but let's see. I've known you and Scott actually for many years.
Right.
But the reason that most people might know something about me is that I am on a, I don't want to say rival because I don't think of it that way, but we are on another podcast, which has also somewhat been in hiatus for the last 6 months or so
Oh,
for
really?
much similar reasons to what Scott's going through.
Right.
My co-host on the Model Railcast show, he's been in a similar situation where he took on more responsibility at work, and he's been just, he's got six kids, and I don't know how he finds time to breathe, let alone do much of anything else.
Yes, yeah, that pesky
But
intrusion
so
of real life into what you really want to be doing.
it's true, and he has plenty of it. And of course, me being in the job that I'm in now, they send me out of the state for probably about 3 or 4 months out of the year. So it's been very tough to try to make it happen and get something else out. But we've been talking, we're trying to get something else out fairly soon, I hope. Maybe by the end of this month. So maybe in May we might actually have a show out, which would really be great. But as I was saying, we do the Model Railcast show, and we've had a lot of good success with it. I think we've done about 230 or so shows now. We've been
Wow.
around for quite a while. It started out with a gentleman named Ryan Anderson, who
Sure.
was the first gentleman who started it off, and Tim came to join him. And after a while, I joined in too. And then, unfortunately, about 3 or 4 years ago, we lost Ryan to lung cancer, which was a real shame. And he and I, so Tim and I have both tried to help keep it going in the meantime. So we hope to keep that
If
tradition
you were
going.
to ask me how many shows that we've done, I haven't the faintest, foggiest idea.
Ah, well,
It's
we have
probably
somebody
not
who's.
200, but on the other hand, I really
It
don't
might
know.
be. You guys have been doing this for a while. I mean, just about as long as we have, if not longer.
Now, were you guys monthly, basically, or
For quite a while, we were. And in
no?
fact, point, we were turning them out about once every 2 weeks.
Okay.
So there was a period where we were very active. But
well,
in the last couple of years...
We had delusions for a little while of doing a weekly show, and we tried that for about a month and realized, well, we've systematically wrung all the fun out of this, haven't we?
Absolutely, yeah. It's funny how that happens, right?
It becomes a content monster, you know? It's like this thing that
it really
needs to
does.
Be
you
fed.
Have to feed the beast, yeah, there's no doubt.
So, you know, I said to Scott, you know, with all, for me, with all things trains, if it's not fun, we're not doing it right. You know, we need to figure out what would make it fun and make sure we go in that direction, you know. And like we were talking about earlier about trying to get everybody's schedules to align and all that, it had gotten to the point with the last cast of characters that everybody gets very busy. Trying to get four people's schedules to align is exponentially more difficult, you know. So
no doubt, this
way with Scott and I up until recently anyway, we've been able to get at least our two schedules to align. So we'll have to see if we can get the ship righted and make sure that doesn't become the new normal now with him not being as available as before.
Well, I tell you what, whenever Scott can't perform, I'll be happy to step in and see if I can help.
Well, I hope you're serious about that, because be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, I know, right?
Well, you know, I think you and I run into each other sporadically, of course, and I think we're I think we communicate online a heck of a lot more than we see each other in person. But
that
we just ran into each other again down at the proto meet in Malvern, Pennsylvania.
Yes, that's right.
That was a good meet. I always enjoy going to that meet. I had missed the last one. Which is never a good thing for a meet that is only every other year, because it
That's
meant
true.
That the last time I was down there was 4 years ago. And I think the really disturbing thing was that 4 years seemed like it went by in about 5 minutes. So it kind of shows you how busy that you can get at times.
It was really interesting because I sat in on your clinic, and which, of course, when Mike comes to most of these shows, he sits down and he does a here's what's been going on since the last time we were here.
Right.
And so it was really eye opening to see how much has happened on your railroad in that
putting
last
that together 4 years. For me, I was shocked at where the layout was only 4 years ago. You know, so when people ask me sometimes when they come over, you know, gee, how long have you been working on this? I just can't give a straight answer to that, because I usually say, well, which version of the layout are we talking about? Because 100% of it has changed. There's not one thing left from the from the start, you know. And I think if there's anything that I've picked up from my buddy Confalone, it's you know, no sacred cows, and don't get bogged down with permanent, you know, takes a long time to do it construction, because things change. You know, you're going to change your mind about things. New techniques are going to come along that you want to take advantage of. And, you know, your original thoughts may not be what you end up with. You know, new materials come out,
absolutely.
New techniques. So I would say that I probably made more progress in the last 4 years than in the, you know, 16 or 18 years before that combined.
Yeah, well, based on your last clinic, I'd say that's evident, yes.
Well, it, you know, I had a hard time actually condensing all of the activity into that time slot.
Oh, yeah, so, how do you fit 4 years into 1 hour?
Right. And, you know, I hadn't done a clinic.
Even with pictures, you know?
Yeah, I think the last clinic I did was in Enfield 2 years ago. So I also was wondering if I was going to be a little rusty. And, you know, you're a clinician. You do clinics all the time. I don't know about you, but when I finish a clinic, the first thing I do is find somebody that I know and say, did that make any sense at all, or was I just babbling? You can't tell in real time how it
Especially
went.
Especially when you're doing a new one. Without
right.
And you do a new one every time.
Pretty
you know, you never
much,
do the
yeah.
same thing over and over.
Well, I went through a period for a while where I did weathering clinics a lot, and they were always variations on a theme. But, you know, it was a lot of the same content, and it was a very popular clinic that I got asked to do a lot. But when it got to the point where I was sick of it, I just couldn't keep doing it.
I understand that. I do. It was a good clinic, though. I remember sitting in on it a few times. I learned a few things.
Well, if it's not interesting to the person giving the clinic, I think that's going to come across. So,
absolutely. Yeah, you've got to have enthusiasm for it, or it's just going to fall flat.
Job one is not to bore the attendees, right?
Well, it helps.
So I really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed that clinic. I honestly, you're going to be surprised at this, but I never even made it into the model room. Between between catching up with people that I hadn't seen in too long, and the really good slate of clinics that they had there, I just never got there. You know,
and that's a real testament to it in that there's so much to do that you just can't do everything.
Exactly, and of course at these proto meets, you're a high energy guy, and I think you just take all of this right in stride. I mean, you're from New Jersey, for Christ's sake. You know, it does nothing
for
phases
sure,
you, right? But, I live a relatively quiet, rural life here, in the wilds of Dartmouth. So when I go to a proto meet, for me, it's like drinking from a fire hose, I always need like a few days to just sort of decompress after an event.
Oh yeah, no, without a doubt. I always come home and I'm just it's like Christmas. I mean, visions of all these things that I've learned that I could do and I could apply, and it does. It takes a couple of days to just calm down and say, okay, where do I need to move next?
Yeah, to digest it all. Absolutely. I guess there were some standouts there. My buddy Ken Karlowitz. I don't know if you were at his clinic or not.
No, I missed it. I didn't get there in time.
He did a tremendous presentation, and although he's he's an experienced guy just in general, he has not done between you and I, we've probably done 150 clinics. I mean, been around the block a couple of times. I don't think that Ken has done more than a couple of model railroad clinics. So I was impressed that he went up there and just killed it. He's got a good he's got a good personality for it. He knows the material, obviously, but he is a superb modeler and photographer. And the pictures that he put up of his layout were just elicited oohs and ahs, throughout the whole presentation. When he got done, I went up to him and I said, "Boy, I'm glad I'm not following your clinic."
I got very good reports from him that people who stopped into his clinic to watch, everybody said it was really good.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. Another clinic I enjoyed a lot was Lance Mindheim's. It's consistently one of the few clinics that I actually sit there and write things down during, because there's always useful and intelligent takeaways from Lance's clinics. He's a guy that's always thinking, he's always breaking new ground, and he's solving in many cases in advance a lot of the problems that you're trying to solve, why reinvent the wheel,
exactly.
I always get several useful things from Lance. So
I saw his clinic this year. I actually made it down to the Cocoa Beach meet back in January, and I saw it there, and I know exactly what you're saying. One of the things with Lance, I always try to make time to hit his clinic, because as you said, he's one of the most thoughtful people,
right,
in terms of considering and looking at something and saying, how can I get the most out of this in terms of whether it's an image or a design or whatever like that. And he's I like to think of him kind of like a Sherlock Holmes. He's like four or five steps ahead of the rest of us.
Well, it helps that he's a pro.
It does.
But he's an intelligence pro, pro that is also an artist at heart. And he understands, I think, the proper use of light and photo angles. And a lot of the stuff that, that we're seeing more and more people employing in terms of their layout and module photographic techniques, he was on the cutting edge of a lot of that stuff. He was doing it, five, six, 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. So,
and he still is. I think some of the stuff he's doing now with his LA Junction layout is just jaw-dropping.
And, I give him credit for not holding his cards close to the vest, and he's just very generous with disseminating this knowledge. You know, so I just wanted to give him some props on that, because he's a good guy, and I've known him a long time, and it was just kind of good to hook up with him again.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. Same thing. I mean, he's one of the nicest people. You can go up to him in the hallway or whatever, and he's always got time to talk to whomever, and no question is a stupid question. He is definitely one of the most generous people in the hobby I've known.
Absolutely. So since you are a clinic attendee of mine,
okay,
I would like to ask you what leapt out of it for you? Like what one significant takeaway, if any, did you have from it? What maybe surprised you or made you raise an eyebrow or anything like that?
Well, the thing I think that jumped out at me the most, which always when I'm in a situation like this is always the thing that does, is the speed with which you work. And I mean, you are not joking when you say that in 4 years, you've pretty much completely revamped your layout from soup to nuts.
It's true.
And it's just watching the photos and hearing how everything went. And, I've been to see your layout, which is outstanding. And, but being able to just watch all that, and it's just like, my God,
I
can't
even imagine.
Well, when
you see it unfold like
that,
you have a whole different appreciation for it. Since you're a layout builder yourself, you know how much energy goes into it,
Oh, for certain, yes.
And I work in these furious spurts of activity. So, since the last one closed down, which was like right around the end of December, which was the last significant furious building spurt where I did all those grain facilities, I haven't really done a whole hell of a lot on the layout. I've been focusing on some locomotive and freight car projects that have been sitting in drawers literally for years while I was more layout focused.
And I've got a few of those too.
Who doesn't, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of that's driven by the fact that the addition project is kind of frozen a lot of layout kind of development, and it's soaking up all of the oxygen in the room while I pour a lot of thought into that. Some people work sort of like in real time with their hands on the layout. There's all kinds of different ways of doing it. I have to have it in my head before I can build anything. Mm-hmm. I have to be able to visualize it. And I mean, I go through periods of time. It might be 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, where all I do is think about how I'm trying to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be frustrating for me because you want to be doing it, but you can't. I can't do it until I can sort of see it in my mind's eye. And my wife always tells me to relax during these times, even though I'm sort of like, pacing like a caged animal at times.
Sure.
Because she said these are fallow periods in creativity, and you need that in order to sort of, regenerate your mind's eye and be able to conceive of what it is you're trying to make.
Sure, because otherwise you'll just burn out.
Yeah, and I don't think everybody works in the same way. I mean, you're an intense guy. I'm told I'm an intense guy. I don't know. But I have my moments, obviously. I also am determined to not have it become just a project to manage. I mean, I'm a project manager, and you work with project managers all the time.
Yes, I do.
And if it feels like work when it's supposed to be fun, you're probably not doing it right. I've even found a way to enjoy making 3,000 trees. So,
that's really tough. I'm very impressed by that.
If you can
it's
do
funny
that,
that you're saying that, because I have a very different approach to it. In that, I like you said, you're very methodical and very thoughtful about trying. Like you said, you have to see it all ahead, and then it's jump in and it's furious activity. For me, I kind of come at it the other way, and I'm more of a chaotic kind of approach. I'd like, oh, that's really interesting. Let me do that. And I'll sit down and do that for 2 or 3 days, and I'll make a lot of progress on it. And then some other like bright flashy thing will come along and go, oh, that's really cool. I want to do that. And then,
Squirrel.
I'm off doing another project. So I probably have 25 different projects going on at any given time.
Right. Well, I used to be like that, and I found I just wasn't, accomplishing completing certain things. So I won't stay with something just to finish it in order to get it done. But what I will do is make sure I'm setting realistic goals for the project. You know, I've done enough of this that I kind of have a sense of how long something should take, roughly speaking. And I get my mind right about that fact so that I'm not halfway into it and getting bored with it. You know, I try to like visualize the process.
I love that. And I wish I could do that.
Well, it's, you know, it's something you have to aim for. I don't think it just happens organically, but you know, at one point, you know, when I realized how much I had to redo in order to have me be happy with what was down there, I realized I couldn't be messing around, with plaster cloth and old methodology and procrastination and all of that. And some of that is also where you are in life. You know, I'm a little bit older now. Happily remarried, you know, content with fill in the blank. So I mean, I'm kind of in a good place where I can focus on stuff like that and not feel like I'm fiddling while Rome is burning, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that helps a lot too.
Yeah, and I hope that one day I'll get to that point too.
Well, I
but
mean, you're a good deal
chaotic,
younger than me, right?
I have a lot of fun with it. So
you're like what? Very early 50s or late 40s?
55.
Oh, 55. Okay. So you're not that far behind me.
Oh, not too far.
I'm going to be 62
hence
this summer.
Hence the streamlined appearance, yes.
Right. We don't look gray, do we?
No, we don't.
The thing, I guess, that's got my juices flowing here is this addition project and the potential for what I can do with that room. And also what it's going to do for me from a methodology standpoint, because as part of the project, not only am I expanding the layout footprint, but I'm also able to have all these other things that I do in the hobby, such as the sound installs for Dartmouth Locomotive Works and just like general organization. You know, when you chase out every conceivable cranny of your basement to do trains in, one of the side effects of that is you don't have a place to put anything.
Oh yeah, I'm very familiar with that. Yes.
I'm now in the situation where it's almost materials gridlock, in that if I have to find something and I can't like immediately put my hands on it, I will definitely spend more time trying to find it than doing it, and that's such a waste.
That, oh, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm creating as part of this project a model railroad supplies pantry. It's a 9x10 room. I'm yanking two oil tanks out of there and pouring a new floor when I pour the whole floor, and it's just going to be shelving and bins and one wall for like plywood and stuff like that. And everything is coming out from under the layout. It's all getting organized. It's all getting labeled. And I think it's going to enable me to work on the build out efficiently, you know, in a way that you just I couldn't do otherwise. And I'm going to exercise the discipline to make sure that I do that first, because if I don't, I think I'll be screwed. I think I'll just bog down.
Yeah, you might be. So, yeah, that's a great idea. But if anybody can do it, I know that you can.
Well, it's funny. I've had like a very interesting past, 2.5 weeks or so here. My wife said, "Chris, you're running around here like a pregnant woman getting ready to give birth." You know, I'm nesting. I'm like tying up loose ends left and right. I cleaned out the attic. I filled my dumpster 3 times in 1 week and had to call them to come and empty it. I'm just, I'm trying to clear the ways of everything, so that when everything starts going down, I can focus on just that. I've cleared up virtually all of the locomotive install backlog. I mean, I've got, at any given time, two or three units sitting there to do, but it's not like I have, 20 units sitting there to do. So it's like a manageable number that I can feel good about going into the project having there, as opposed to feeling like I'm under the gun with it, So I've basically done everything I can to ensure that I'm not going to, lose any more here.
Well, little chance of that.
Thanks very much. But quite correct. So, you know, that's kind of what's going on with that. Building permits mm-hmm. in the window, and the guys are coming on Tuesday. So,
wow,
that's really when it gets serious. So I think I'm gonna be like a kid in a candy store. I think when this project gets going, and you know, it's definitely going to be one of those projects that's going to require a lot of on the spot decision making. You know,
sure.
A lot of field condition kind of thing. So,
and that's where all that prep work is really going to help.
Absolutely, I'm highly motivated to be actively involved in the decision making on all of this. So, I've been telling you know, friends and people who I usually interact with heavily, if you got any questions, ask me now, because I'm not going to be quite as on tap as usual once everything gets going. And part of the goal there is to make sure that that doesn't go on like that for months and months at a time, you know. So this is another project that I want to do as a, you know, a 6 or 7 week blitzkrieg that allows me to sort of start aiming to getting back to normal life sooner than later. That's the goal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, ask me in 2 months if that actually happens.
When you were talking about this? I was sitting in the audience during your clinic talking about this, and I had Kaylee Zhang next to me.
Ah, yes. Another thinker.
And you're getting in the end, and you're talking about this big new, you know, thing that you're doing here with the expansion. And she looks at me and she says, "How long do you think it's actually going to take?" I'm going to go, 2 weeks.
Wouldn't that be nice? When you're dealing with, if I was doing it, certainly, but when you're dealing with all these different subcontractors and what have you, there's a lot of variables there. And I will feel differently and considerably better once I have a foundation poured, because at that point, there's no obstacle to the builder putting up the walls. And that's you know, that'll go quickly. And once you have a weathertight enclosure there, you can really do some great things.
Oh, you can move then, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, and because this won't be disruptive enough, while the guys are doing the roof, I'm going to have the house roof redone, because it's been 30 years and it's time, and there'll never be a better time to do it. So, it is going to be maximum chaos over a short period of time. I'm
no doubt.
I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, you really do seem to enjoy wresting order out of the chaos, so I think you'll thrive.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of what I do, and sometimes there's some pleasure in taking a situation that any sane person would look at and go, "Yeah, I wouldn't go there," and just say, "No problem. Here's how we do it."
That's it.
Sometimes
you're the man. I tell you what.
So, I wanted to briefly mention or talk about my the latest op session that I went to, which was this weekend up at Mike Confalone's.
Yeah, tell me about that.
You've been up there, right?
Actually, I haven't. I'm dying to go.
Oh, you've never seen Mike's layout. Okay, well,
I've seen the pictures, of course, and, you know, I've spoken to Mike at different shows and all like that, but I've never had the opportunity.
Well, you know, when you see him at a show, that's when you got to pin him down. You know, people always say, "Hey, can you get me into Confalone's?" And I said, "I am not his pimp, you know. You got to it's his home. You got to talk to him directly,
exactly.
You know. I don't make those decisions for him." But okay. Yeah, it's a nice enough layout that you could see why people would want to experience it. But you know,
oh, sure, yes.
Again, it's a different story when it's in your home and you've got a busy life as it is, and you've got your A team of operators, you know, that mesh, and you know, you look forward to having these people over and doing your thing. And I think a lot of layouts are like that. You know, they have their
their
regular crew, and they've got a spare board, and you know, sometimes if somebody's coming in from out of town or whatever, you know, you can have them come over and see the layout. But it's a little different being part of the ops crew. You know, to me, two different activities.
Yeah, that's one of my things that I always talk about, is that you've really got to have, if you want to have really successful operations, you've got to have a core group that, you know, has been there before, who knows the ropes, who know the railroad and know their jobs. And well, that just makes it go so much smoother.
It really is night and day. Up at Confalone's, you know, he often consults with me as to what I might, you know, feel like doing. And I was telling him, I said, look, there are no bad jobs on the Allegash if you're running a locomotive. So if you need me, like this past time, I was working with Jim Reddington as the engineer at New Sharon, and there's a yard there. There's two different towns that you go out and service. There's a different job where you get on a turn over to the main classification yard at Madrid. I spent a very, very engaging and enjoyable day there, and at 6 o'clock when he threw everybody out because we wouldn't go home, I had no idea it was 6 o'clock. The time just flew by. I was astonished.
Those are the best
sessions.
Those are the best.
Yep. So it's, you know, it's consistently a great operating experience, and I've been happy to see a lot of the same guys when they operate as part of my crew seem to be really enjoying themselves here. It wasn't always that way. You know, people need to learn the layout. You have to get all the bugs out. You have to figure out how you're going to run this op session. You know, it's kind of like thing to orchestrate, as you know. I think of like Dave Ramos's layout, you know, and he's invited me over, and it's, you know, it's one of those things on my list of things I would love to do. But I look at the complexity of his operation there, and I think, boy, how long does it take to be good at running his layout, you know?
Well, you know, I mean, I've been over there many times. We live in the same town.
Right.
I've been over there many times, and it's much more intimidating than it actually is.
Really?
To actually work. Oh yeah, it really is. I mean, there's a flow to it.
Okay.
Particularly if you're talking about, say, like the car float operations that he does. For those of you who don't know, Dave has a New York Harbor Railroad layout, which models the pocket yards in New York City on the west side, the Erie Yard, the Lehigh Valley Yard, I believe, and he also does a section of the New York Central High Line and the New York Central's 30th Street Yard. And the hardest part that everybody freaks out about is the car floats, and because it seems like, oh my God, you know, it's a time thing, and you got to have it done in a certain amount of time, and there's very little room to work because there's all these tracks, but they're already filled with cars.
Sure.
And it's very intimidating. But once you finally understand what you need to do, which really doesn't take very long, it's very simple. And
really? It looks like you're playing 3D chess.
And you kind of are. because what happens is that, you know, you've got basically the way that it works is you've got three things to do. One is you've got a car float coming in with cars that have to be spotted.
Right.
You've got cars that are currently spotted that have to be moved to the outbound area so they can be reloaded. And then you've got those cars that have got to get back onto the float.
So it sounds like a typical major yard operation.
It really is. It's just that it's boiled down into a very small area, and there's no real lead. But the idea is that if you think about it in terms of the way you run any operation when you're running a train, you always have to do the pickups before you can do the setouts, right? Because otherwise, you have nowhere to put any cars. And so what you do is if you have everything ready to go, meaning that you've got the cars that are going to be going onto the car float ready, what you can do is the first thing you do is then the car float gets there, you pull off the cars that are coming in and you get them kind of out of the way, and then basically just pull them in, kind of for-now them into certain spots where you get, and then immediately you load up the car float in order to get rid of the cars that are leaving.
Sure, and that frees up space. You need to clear some space. I always tell people that are working Mahoopany for the first time, you know, you're going to get 3 to 4 road trains through here in the course of an operation. They're all going to be giving you stuff. You better be prepared to give them stuff, or you're going to be bogged down in no time. Exactly, be gridlocked. So how do you guys at Dave's handle the operations of the movements of the cars? I assume there's some kind of card or manifest kind of a situation.
In that case, for the car floats, the system that Dave came up with, which I actually helped him with, I wrote him a program that actually writes switch lists. And so basically what we do with that is that
what became From Here to There?
Part of it, no. Actually, the part that became here to there is the part that he runs on the High Line and in the 30th Street Yard area.
Okay.
Because that does work with waybills, the way that we would normally work with car cards and waybills on a regular railroad.
Right.
But the car floats are a different story. He tried for a couple of years to actually make it work with the cards, but it was just too much turnover, and it was too hard to keep track of where everything was.
You needed a full-time clerk.
Exactly. And, in fact, they had a board that had been generated by, I want to say it was Ron Parisi, who was one of the first people to try this, or it might have been Vincent Lee. I'm not sure. It was either one of the two of them. And they had a board that you'd set up with all the spots on the railroad, and you'd be able to, as you did things, you take it and put the cars into this big board to say where that they were. But it was just, you were moving too quickly to keep it up.
Now, wait a minute. I want to make sure I understand. So you have a board on the wall.
Right. Well, actually on a desk, but yes.
Okay. And it's got a grid of some kind? And,
yeah,
and
every
spot
like a
represents a car spot?
Yeah, it's like a series of car card boxes that are set on a large board, and they're set out in such a way as they mimic the layout of where all the tracks are.
Okay.
Okay. So the idea was that when you'd pick up a car or a string of cars and move it, you'd pick them up and then move them over the same way that you would when you would regularly work a train at a regular industry.
It's kind of ingenious when you think about it.
Yeah, but it didn't work.
Oh, it didn't work.
No, because you were moving too quickly. It was because of the way that things work there, and the fact that there's so little room to work, you're constantly moving things around. It was impossible to keep up with it.
You couldn't keep up. I gotcha.
Exactly. So what ended up happening is that he decided it would be best to go to switch lists.
Okay.
And so we wrote a program that allows the person setting everything up. Basically, what you'd do is you'd pick about, I think it's around 15 cars that come in on every car float, and you'd put them in. And the program would basically say, okay, fine, I now have these three tracks that are the card float with five spots each, and I'm going to assign a spot on each one of these floats to one of these cars, which then you write in the reporting mark and the number.
Right.
Okay. And then the next thing is, okay, fine, so I've got that. The next thing is I take the cars that are going to be leaving, and I'm going to put them and assign them basically onto the car float, even though that's not as important where they go. But basically I'm just going to tell the computer, okay, these cars from the outbound yard are going to go onto the float. And that clears up the spots for the stuff that's over on the inbound yard to be moved. And what you do is you start dragging and dropping, because it's basically a graphical interface. And
so you're using the computer in real time?
Well, actually, no. He uses it. You could, but he actually uses it ahead of time. And he'll stage four or five car floats for each yard before the session.
Okay.
And he'll have all the switch lists printed out. So what happens is, like I'm saying, you would take this and then drag all the stuff over from the inbound yard and put them into spots in the outbound yard where they need to go. And then finally, you'd take the cars on the inbound float and move them, the cars there, into where they needed to go in the inbound yard. And what you've done at that point is you've basically set up all the movements that you need to do.
Okay.
Okay. And so then it's, okay, fine, I'm done. Spit it out. You hit print, and it sends you three different switch lists. One is for loading the car float. One is for moving cars from the inbound yard to the outbound yard. And one is for moving cars from the float onto the inbound yard.
How long do you think it takes him to stage a session, you know, to plan it and stage it and get ready?
Well, I think as with experience, I know it takes about 15 minutes to set up each car float and get all the movements down. So if he does four or five car floats for each yard, that's a couple of hours right there, about 3 hours to do all that.
Right.
And then the New York Central areas, the High Line and the 30th Street area, they're done with a different method. They're done with a it's basically what Here to There is based on, which is a waybills-only system with disposable waybills. And unlike what I did, Dave just set up a Excel spreadsheet with all the industries that he has. And basically all he has to worry about is moving cars in and then moving cars back out again.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is that for every train that comes in, he sets it up and he prints out all the basically the waybills, which include what's in the car and where does it need to go.
Right.
Okay. And then He takes that, builds out the train, but in building it out, he picks the first waybill and says, okay, this is a load of bearings that's going to this factory that's over here, and it's coming from Chicago. Okay, well, now it's bearings, so it's going to go in a boxcar, an XM, and I need to put it into a car that's either coming back to the New York Central or the Eastern United States, or a car coming from Chicago. So he has his car set up so that he can pull a boxcar that's either a Eastern car that it would be coming back after being reloaded in Chicago, or a Chicago area car that could be bringing it in. So he'll pick that car and he'll write down the car information, the road number and the road name on that car. And then that car will go into the train and the bill will go into the pack. And he'll do this for every car in the train. So what's happening is, instead of staging like you would normally have on a regular railroad where you run a 15, 20 car train, you do a little switching with it, and then it ends up in hidden staging at the end of the layout. And then in between sessions, you'd pull it out and you generally at that point flip the waybills in the car card.
Yep.
Right? Because there's a car card that goes with each car. And there's usually a waybill in there that has anywhere from 2 to 4 destinations. So, and it's designed, as you know, to pick up from where you're coming from, the current staging yard, and it'll take it back onto the railroad and eventually usually out to another staging yard. And then it'll come back on again and basically ping pong, you know, those four movements. And so the car card stays with, or the waybill stays with that car and that car card most of the time to make it easier to basically recycle that train in staging. You won't have to really do much more than change out a couple of cars, swap the engine and the caboose, and you're pretty much good to go. It's staged to go back the other way in the next session.
Right. See, but we had I think everybody's kind of got the same issue more or less.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to be trying to, you know, move things around in a prototypical way as opposed to aimlessly. So a lot of what you're saying sounded very familiar to me. Now,
right.
What changed things quite a bit was when Pittston Yard came into being,
mm-hmm.
and we started running locals out of Pittston Yard, and now these things are coming back not to staging.
Okay.
But now they're coming back to Pittston Yard, and they need to have a destination, an interim destination, basically. You need to know what train they're going to leave the yard on.
Sure, of course.
I was scratching my head about, you know, how the heck we were going to handle that. And, you know, I've discussing this stuff with, you know, people like Confalone, and eventually mm-hmm. he said, you know, what about if you did a gateway? You know, what if you had a something on your switch list where you could check off as the decision maker, okay, this goes out via the Buffalo Gateway, or this goes out via Binghamton, or this goes mm-hmm. out via Allentown. And just adding that one little thing enabled us to designate things coming back from these industries via the locals,
right? And then we're to send
tell
them
the yard
to...
guy what to do at that point, you know?
Right.
I've got a
and
very
that's a really that's a valid way to work it.
I've got a very good yard guy in Joe Posick, and he runs Mike Confalone's Madrid yard, and he's at the point now where he just gets into this, you know, this zen state there where he's just like all in the yard. And he doesn't even want, it doesn't help him to assign him a helper. It's better when he's just like this one being who
right. and
just
in
sort
the
of
zone.
Handles
yeah.
it. So and all of that was wonderful, except there was one session I ran where he wasn't going to be there.
Uh-oh.
And I thought, uh-oh. He's the only guy who knows that job, really.
Yeah, that's a danger. That's a real danger.
Well, we kind of did it by committee, you know, and it worked out just fine. But it wasn't the most relaxing session from my standpoint that I ever ran. It was okay. A good time, but it greatly, I think, upped the ante of what I was trying to keep track of as the layout host, you know, at that
oh,
time.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Interesting. So, the only thing I wanted to touch on beyond this was I was wondering what you knew about the Iowa Engineering Proto Throttle. You familiar with that?
I've seen pictures of it.
Okay, well, I have one here.
You have one? How interesting.
I have one here. I'm on the rotating testing crowd.
Okay.
And I felt fortunate to be on that list,
Yeah.
and a little flattered that they cared at all about my thoughts on it. And the first thing I noticed when I got it out of the box was, wow, what a well done piece of engineering. You know, it just looked very well made and very authentic. And I didn't know what I was expecting. It was probably slightly larger than I expected, so I wasn't sure how I was going to like, holding it and handling it as compared to my usual, the NZE stuff that I'm used to using. But it proved to be kind of like a, a non-issue. Yeah, it's different, but yeah, it's different. So it like it wasn't, the fact that it was different wasn't a problem or an issue. You know, it was just something different. The first thing I noticed about it was after we got it connected up to the layout, which once you, change a few settings and what have you, it just connected right into the NCE command bus with ease. And the
Now, is
NCE.
I don't mean to interrupt, but is it a tethered throttle or is it wireless?
No, it's wireless. And
It is wireless.
that's actually where I was going next. So, the NCE wireless is just kind of okay. It's got, I mean, it's okay. It doesn't blow me away. I love NCE equipment, and I wouldn't trade my NCE system for anything really. I would like the radio portion of it to work better than it does. I have a feeling that if I were to go back and forth with NCE, they would work with me to help me improve that. And I was
Yeah,
starting to
very
do a little
likely.
bit of that before I got sidetracked. But, without really knowing anything and without really doing anything, I think the Digitrax radio is probably a step above the NCE radio.
The duplex one.
I mean, I do like the way that you interact with an NCE system in every way, and I love the way you consist and all of that. So, I'm not about to trade it, but it's like the one thing where I think there's, from my experience, room for improvement. So, the first thing I did with this was let's see how the radio is on it. There's no antenna that I'm aware of. The interface was just this little board, like a little circuit board, like the size of an iPhone. And I just plugged it into a 2-port UTP and sat it on the layout table and started walking away from it. And I went to the exact opposite corner of my basement with the entire furnace room full of copper pipes, air conditioner, all the ducts and everything in between me and it. And it worked perfectly. So I thought, huh? So I went outside. I went into my workshop and closed the two steel doors and stood behind them, and it worked perfectly.
No.
And I don't understand how that's even possible.
Wow.
I really
Okay.
don't. It's maybe
You know
because
what the
it's
real
more of a
test is going to be,
Wi-Fi
though?
type
Stand right next to
technology
it
or
and see what
something, but
happens.
it was just super impressive.
Yeah.
So that's about the extent I've gotten with it.
Okay.
I've used it in the same fashion as I would with one of my regular NCE throttles. It interacted nicely with all of the features that I'm used to with my Loke sound decoders. And I showed it to the guys up at Confluence Op Session. I couldn't really test it there because there's two different versions of it. One would work on NCE and one would work on Digitrax, among others. So, it's not like we could just plug it in and play with it up there, but I kind of wanted to see how the guys would react to it, And there's the usual mixed reaction of some people thought, "Wow, this is the coolest thing," and some people said, "Ah, it's so big," So, I think it's one of those things you have to sort of use to be able to see how it hits you.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of wondering about because it's got all the controls on it that you would expect to be using in a normal diesel locomotive. I mean, you've got the throttle, you've got the brake, there's a and they're handled obviously
The
differently from the way
reverser.
that you would do it on a regular NCE throttle.
That's right. That's
So it's
right.
got to be a very different experience.
I looking at it. There's no labeling or anything. I found myself looking at the diagram just to make sure I was familiar with what control was what.
Okay.
And some of that's because it can be dynamically reassigned in some cases. You know, it's
okay.
very flexible in terms of how you can set it up. And I think I've only scratched the surface on that. But I think what I was surprised at was how straightforward it was and how easily I was able to get it to replicate all of the functionality that I was used to. So I found that very quickly I was doing all the same things with it that I normally would, you know.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah, so with a completely different form factor and control set, that was, I think, not something I expected.
No, and that's actually a real, you know, something that's really good about it then, because if it's something that it's that easily to chew, what's the word I'm looking for? Shoot. To just move into, you know, from, you know, a completely different throttle experience, but you were still able to do all the things that you wanted to do. That's
yeah.
that's a really good feature.
It's kind of a prerequisite, right? If you're trying to get people to change from what they're used to using to something completely different. Now,
right.
I suspect I've only scratched the surface with this. You know, the throttle itself is in a radically different price point from just the typical NCE throttle. So,
right.
you know,
which are also not cheap to start with.
No, so. They're not. But I mean, you know, this is definitely not cheap either.
No.
On the other hand, based on what I saw, it would also save you from buying all kinds of radio repeaters and antennas and all of that. I mean, the wireless was just incredible. So, you know, you almost have to look at it not on a how much does this throttle cost, but how much does this total solution cost, and compare it in a more fair fashion, you know?
Right,
so,
right.
I give the guys at Iowa a lot of credit for doing a very, very sensible rollout and testing. I know Joe Atkinson out in Iowa has been beta testing one for them for like a year. So they've got a lot of feedback from people who are active model railroad runners. You know what I mean? So I think they're doing all the right things. And I'm going to try to see what I can discover about it in the next week that I have with it before I have to forward it on to the next guy. But if I come up with anything earth-shattering, I'll make sure I mention it on the next show.
Yeah, I look forward to that.
So is there anything else you want to tell the listeners here, Craig, before we sign off?
Oh, not too much, really. I basically, you know the stuff I've been working on for quite a while. And one of the things that I've been doing lately, which unfortunately slash fortunately has been keeping me out of the layout room, is I've been doing a lot of work with 3D printing.
Yes.
And also some laser cutting as well. For those who don't know, I have a small line of laser cut early period, meaning before 1890. Car kits. I know.
Go ahead and say it out of necessity.
out of necessity, because I do model the 1890s, and it's very difficult to find equipment, so that's one of the reasons for it. But the other thing is that some of the gentlemen that I work with got me kind of involved with an inexpensive 3D printer that they already had a copy of, and they encouraged me to get one, and I've been going gangbusters on it in my chaotic method lately.
And not just with train stuff, from what I saw.
Well, that's the thing, and the idea for me is that I've been kind of printing out a lot of interesting, you know, doodads and things, but the idea,
of
course,
when you can make anything, you know, the temptation is to do just that.
That's exactly right. And I've done some really cool stuff. I made myself a lightsaber, which was kind of neat. And I made a little trebuchet, which is like a catapult. That was neat. But the idea of now that I'm kind of getting this experience with it and kind of learning how to really get good results out of it, one of the things that I'm trying to start learning how to do is to do more of the 3D design. And the idea of what I want to do with it is I want to start trying to make either entire cars with it or car sides that can then be cast in resin,
right?
In order to prove,
in other words, prototyping.
Exactly, and then but also the other thing is that all of a sudden with 3D printing, it's not just those things, but it's also details and other things like that. That all of a sudden, I'll give you an example. One of the kits that I make is a Pennsylvania Railroad XC boxcar, which were built, I think, around 1886, 1887. Well, they had a variant of it, the Pennsylvania did, called the XD, which was a ventilated boxcar. And it's almost exactly the same.
Is it a cattle car?
No, it's actually a vegetable and a fruit cart type of thing. Okay. But right, so it's ventilated for that. And it had a Eastman heater underneath it. In fact, it was one of the very first cars ever to have an Eastman heater. But one of the cool things about it is that unlike most ventilated cars that you'd normally see, it had these really interesting metal scoops on the top, one facing in each direction. And the idea being that when the train was in motion, you'd suck air in and kind of ventilate the car that way.
Ah.
And it's really neat, but nobody makes this detail part, because it's incredibly obscure.
Right, right.
Well, now, all of a sudden, you know, if I want to be able to turn this out, I can fairly easily, as soon as I figure the software out, which I'm in the process of doing, but it should be fairly simple to make a 3D printed plastic part that I could then, you know, make for these scoops and maybe even the Eastman heater as well. And then all of a sudden, I can take this XC car and I can start offering it as an XD to customers.
Well,
and
so the question that came to mind while you were explaining this is, okay, you're a computer programmer by trade. How would it be for us mere mortals to try to do this kind of thing?
Well, you know, it's, I will say, I mean, I kind of have the opinion of the, many of the things that I do. Well, gee, I can do this. Why can't anybody else do this? It seems simple to me, you know. I mean, so I've been doing a lot of stuff with etching and other things like that. And, you know, it's like people are like, oh, my goodness. And I'm like, no, it's really not that bad. It's really simple. But apparently a lot of times what I think is really simple tends to be a little intimidating to others.
You think?
But a little bit. You know, but like I said, I tend to be very chaotic. I get very interested in these things. And I tend to throw myself into it for a couple of weeks. So I learn a lot very quickly. And with this, it's the – I will say that the software, the one that I'm trying to learn, there's a free version of it you can get from Autodesk called Fusion 360. Mm-hmm. And it's a great, great program. There's a lot of really good videos online in order to actually learn how to use it. And I'm actually, I my wife is very excited. She had these little lights in her backyard that broke, and they needed a bracket, basically, that broke and to be fixed. And I actually sat down yesterday, and in the process of about, I don't know, an hour, I actually completely, you know, redesigned this bracket and 3D printed it and fixed her lights. She was thrilled.
Wow.
But I'm like, you know, this is like the first time I ever used this. You know, I've watched, like I said, about 6 or 7 hours of videos. But I was actually able, you know, for the first time to sit down and say, okay, fine, draw a circle, extrude the circle, you know, add another thing here and, you know, change the attitude and make this thing. And it's once you kind of start learning how to do it, it kind of is not that bad. I mean,
so
you found it
intuitive.
I really did, actually. Yeah. And it's different from like drawing in like Corel Draw or something else like that. It's a very different process. But when you start doing it, as you said, it's really quite intuitive. And you can, once you know how to do a couple of things, it really kind of starts opening up. And then you learn more techniques to do things. And, you know, just in those last couple hours, I learned quite a bit. And I'm actually going to be taking that and I'm going to start trying to this week, trying to actually start doing a 3D printed boiler for a steam engine model that I've been wanting to build for a long time. So if I can get that to work, then I'm going to really be happy.
Well,
that's kind of a complicated shape and everything. So if I can get that to work, I think I can really, that'll kind of open the doors for me and I'm going to be able to start doing a lot of interesting things.
This sounds like a really interesting subject that probably deserves more time than we're going to give to it right now. How about if we can make the planets align at some point in the not too distant future and talk about mm-hmm. this a little bit more detailed fashion and I'll probably have a lot more questions at that time. You know me, I'm always interested in stuff.
Of course. Yeah, well, you and me both.
Well, I really appreciate your sitting in for Scott, as does Scott. And I will be posting this show right away so that people don't go through show withdrawal. So with any
Certainly
luck,
don't.
it actually recorded. And if it didn't, well, we're probably
We'll
going to have
do
a hard time topping this one. So maybe we'll, you know, go to plan B at that point. But
All
confidence
right.
springs eternal, right?
Well, absolutely. And thank you very much, Mike, for the opportunity. And it's been really a lot of fun.
All right, Craig, we'll be talking to you soon.